Hi, I'm Frances Fry.
And I'm Ann Morris.
And we are the hosts of a new TED podcast called Fixable.
We've helped leaders at some of the world's most competitive companies solve all kinds of problems.
On our show, we'll pull back the curtain and give you the type of honest, unfiltered advice we usually reserve for top executives.
Maybe you have a coworker with boundary issues, or you want to know how to inspire and motivate your team.
Give us a call, and we'll help you solve the problems you're stuck on.
Find Fixable wherever you listen.
In different ways, both sides just aren't straightforwardly engaging with the problem because there's this sense that it's a zero-sum game, right? You either care about women and girls or boys and men. If the former you're on the left, the latter you're on the right. Whereas in fact, actually, we can think two thoughts at once.
Gender, like race and class, has long been a third rail issue in politics and business. Nuanced public debate is hard to come by, and policymakers have often taken a zero-sum approach in matters of education and employment. A close examination of the labor market, however, reveals troubling trends for America's men. Most, particularly those without a college degree, earn less than their 1970s forefathers. Their academic attainment increasingly lags that of women. And 1 in 6 prime working-age males are out of work, 1 in 8 permanently. But does the current polarized atmosphere preclude outside-the-box solutions? Welcome to the Managing the Future of Work podcast from Harvard Business School. I'm your host, Harvard Business School professor and visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Joe Fuller. I'm joined by Richard Reeves, whose latest book is Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. Richard is a senior fellow in economics at the Brookings Institution, where he directs the Boys and Men Project. In this first segment of our two-part episode, we'll discuss how boys develop socially and neurologically, and ideas for promoting gender equity, ranging from de-gendering professions like teaching and social work, to the adoption of more father-friendly social and workplace policies. We'll also talk about alternative learning models, like apprenticeship and work-based learning, that offer the promise of advancing boys' interests. Welcome to the podcast, Richard.
Thank you for having me on, Joe.
Richard, I was excited to talk to you, being an admirer of your historical work, but also particularly in response to your book Of Boys and Men, which was published this past year, in 2022. Could you just start off by sharing with our audience, how would you define the present state of boys, of men, of masculinity, and why is it, should it be a subject of concern?
I have this view that all scholarship is at least partly autobiographical. I have 3 sons that I've raised to their 20s. And so like worrying about boys is like, it's my job. But also in my day job at Brookings, working on inequality issues, class issues, racial equality issues, I just kept stumbling across really strong evidence that many of those were overlapping with, to some extent, explained by, or certainly definitely in relationship with issues around gender. I knew that the economic prospects of many American men weren't great, but I didn't know that most American men today earn less than most American men did in 1979. I knew that there'd been this big overtaking in education, but I didn't know that the gap on U.S. college campuses today is bigger than it was in 1972. When Title IX was passed, just the other way around. That's true throughout the education system. I work on family issues, so I knew some of the family trends, but I didn't know the extent to which we'd seen these kind of increases in fathers struggling to be in touch with their kids. And it's worth saying, I think, immediately that all of this was really thrown into a much sharper light when I looked at it through the lens of both class and race. And I felt like a story about gender and sex was kind of being submerged in some ways by other debates, but also those other debates around class inequality, for example, or racial inequality, really needed more of a gendered lens, because actually you see very different outcomes, for example, between working class men and upper middle class men and women And same with between black men and black women, or black boys and black girls. So you're seeing these really different intersections. But gender is certainly one of them. And on many of those fronts, it is the boys and men who we have reason to be really concerned about.
Richard, one of the many things I enjoyed about the book is you've got consecutive chapters which speak to how you characterize liberals getting these phenomena wrong, followed by one about how conservatives get it wrong. What do you think are the biggest misconceptions people of either ideological end of the spectrum have? And then let's talk a little bit about where you think some solutions may lie.
Yeah, so I think that there is always a danger of this sort of both sides-ism, and I'm very aware that there's an intellectual vanity risk here too. But on the left, I think there has been a real reluctance to just engage with the issues that boys and men are having. They're deep problems, but they're specific to boys and men. So there can only be gender inequalities that affect women and girls. That's sort of baked into the work of the Gender Policy Council in the White House, World Economic Forum, etc. Secondly, the problem on the left is a tendency to individualize the problem, to just say, well, it's a problem of toxic masculinity. It's pathology. I guess the other thing on the left is just a real discomfort with the idea that there are any biological differences at all between boys and girls or men and women. And that's unhelpful in terms of the framing. And I understand the concern, but it's not true, and that's unhelpful. On the right, there's been on the biology thing a tendency to overstate the importance of biology, right? And to say, yes, there are differences, and that's why men won't be nurses and women won't be engineers or whatever, to choose your pick. Particular example. Also a tendency to take the real problems of boys and men and weaponize them into grievances, partly because they're being ignored by a lot of mainstream institutions. It's pretty easy to convince people that actually the reason boys and men are struggling is because, you know, liberal elites hate them, especially if they're working class. And so that's led to a sort of reactionary populist response, I think, is really, really unhelpful, and a kind of sometimes an exhortation to a world that's long gone. You know, when men knew their place, women knew their place, men worked in factories, women worked in the home, you could raise a family on one wage, etc., and everyone was married. And it's sort of just a nostalgia for a world before the women's movement was successful. And I just think that's morally wrong and crazy from a policy point of view to think we can go back in that way. And so in different ways, both sides just aren't straightforwardly engaging with the problem, because there's this sense of is of zero-sum game, right? You either care about women and girls or boys and men. If the former you're on the left, the latter you're on the right. Whereas in fact, actually, we can think two thoughts at once. Most people are perfectly capable of thinking, oh, there's a bunch of problems. It is a problem that, you know, men are, you know, suicide rates among men are rising and three or four times higher than for women. It's also a problem that there aren't enough women on corporate boards, even though there's been a big increase recently.
Well, certainly it does seem that there's a paradigm where many people's positions are rooted in traditional perspectives. But of course, now we have a lot more data. We know, for example, that workforce participation for men has been dropping off at a very consistent rate for over 20 years. We know we have much more data about neural structures and behavioral patterns and cognitive psychology. So as you look at the landscape as it is and try to bring your father of sons informed point of view, what are some things that you believe could improve outcomes for boys and men, and maybe start getting some restoration of balance in the system?
Well, let's start with education, because I know that's also an area you're very interested in too, and I've seen some of your work on community colleges recently. But if you take education, in the average U.S. school district, girls are almost a grade ahead in English and their level in math. In poorer school districts, they're full grade ahead in English and about a third of a grade ahead in math. And of those getting the highest GPAs from high schools, two-thirds of them are girls. Them getting the lowest, two-thirds of them are boys. So various ways in which I think the education system isn't working as well for boys and men as it is for girls and women. So three proposals. Number one is to start boys in school a year later, so so-called redshirting. And so they're a year older as they go through the school system chronologically. And the reason to do that is because boys' brains develop later. So in adolescence, for example, girls prefrontal cortex. So you've mentioned some of the science on this, which is the bit of your brain that's sometimes called the CEO of your brain. It's the bit of your brain that has sort of the executive functioning skills in there. I call it the turn your chemistry homework in bit of your brain, because it's the bit of your brain that remembers that you have chemistry homework, brought the chemistry homework home, did the chemistry homework, took the chemistry homework into school, and turned the chemistry homework into the chemistry class that you're aware you're enrolled in. That's a whole bunch of steps, right? And it turns out that those skills are in this bit of the brain that develops between a year and between 1 and 2 years earlier in girls. And also about predict GPA. It's interesting that actually in standardized tests, there's not much of a gender gap, but you have to turn your chemistry homework in to get a good GPA. So just giving the boys that extra year, I think, would help. The second thing is more male teachers. We're seeing fewer and fewer male teachers in our schools. We're down to 1 in 10 elementary school teachers, fewer than 1 in 4 across K-12. And over the last few decades, you have just sort of seen fewer and fewer men in classrooms. And there is what I can see, particularly in subjects like English, and especially for certain boys, black boys, for example, having male teachers really does seem to help. But we have fewer and fewer male teachers, so a massive recruitment drive of male teachers with scholarship subsidies, etc. I don't think we should just sit by and watch K-12 teaching become an almost entirely female profession without at least a debate about whether that's a good or a bad thing. And the third thing, I think it really does intersect, Joe, with some of your interests, is around more vocational training. So I call for 1,000 new technical high schools, many more apprenticeships, alternative pathways to college. And those, on average, benefit boys and men more than women and girls. It's not that there aren't girls and women who benefit from them, but those applied learning styles, etc., really help. And community colleges, for example, can actually really help provide some skills to help men get into the labor market. And I think you just did a very nice piece of work looking at employer community college connections and trying to find ways to make community college curricula more employment friendly. And I see that in the same vein of this work, which is to make the work kind of more immediately vocationally relevant. But pedagogically, it's also about just more applied learning styles and everything else equal, boys seem to benefit more from that. So an extra year, more male teachers and more applied learning.
Well, it's all very actionable. Have you gotten any pushback from other scholars or thinkers on any one of those, and what's been their critique?
Yeah, I think least of all, actually, on the vocational side, the evidence for the effectiveness of technical high schools and apprenticeships is pretty good. And the evidence that it's particularly good for boys and men is pretty good. So the pushback is not against the first, it's against the second. And so one of the reasons why some people on the left especially are a bit worried about apprenticeships is because they're 90% male. Given that campuses are now 60% female, it seems to me that the fact that apprenticeships seem to be a bit more attractive to men should be seen as a feature rather than a bug. But I do think because it's so gender skewed, there's some reluctance around it. On the male teachers, there's pretty strong support for more male teachers of color. I think that there is still kind of a question as to how good is the evidence that male teachers just per se are good. And I think that the evidence for in terms of narrow academic outcomes is still pretty small. We definitely need more evidence. But for my money, there's actually a broader reason to have men in teaching other than just the kind of measurable effect on the standard deviation, say, on your English competency, which is, for a start, men in schools are more likely to be coaches. Secondly, they do seem to treat behavior problems differently. And third of all, they're men. And so the mere fact of boys seeing men in those roles is important, I think. And I would say on redshirt, the evidence here is just, we need more evidence. Every single educator and principal I've mentioned it to has gone, hell yeah. I'm not saying they're right necessarily, but it's interesting that the kind of, there's a bit of, maybe a bit of epistemic humility here of saying they actually do have lived experience. So it's not the same as a really good randomized control trial with certain outcome measures, but there's some truth in that reaction too. So we'll see. I'd say it's been mixed so far.
Well, certainly as it applies to technical education, vocational education, there are a lot of opportunities for us to affect the lives of boys and young men favorably. Our research certainly indicates that not merely CTE type programs and community colleges, but actually work-based learning in high school has a huge favorable impact. And very importantly, what it does, it provides them the opportunity to begin to develop what are called social, or sometimes unfortunately in the literature, soft skills, punctuality, the ability to communicate in a workplace setting, willingness to ask questions, ability to receive criticisms, skills many kids develop in the home at an earlier age, but unfortunately that doesn't happen in all homes, significantly affects someone's employability and promotability if they've got decent level social skills. So
it's super interesting. I mean, I think those, I was thinking both about the empirics on this, which I think you're right, but just at a personal level, like one of my kids like really struggling in high school and could barely get to class, struggling grades, but he got an after school job, never missed a day, great feedback, learned what it was like to have to show up, had people counting on him to show up. You know, people who cared if he showed up, people who knew when he showed up. I mean, and I was just kind of looking at some data at the moment, but back to this point about looking at race and gender. So looking at state level on time high school graduation rates. And so, for example, in Michigan, the percentage of black boys who graduate high school on time, so within 4 years, is 60%. Right? So that means that like 2 out of 5 black boys in the state of Michigan or having to do another grade or catch up later or get a GED or whatever. So the counterfactual here, when we talk about alternatives like technical high schools, more work-based learning, is the current system. And the current system is so stratospherically failing.
And those failings, of course, also often show up at the front door of the community college, where students show up, they're not ready for college level work. They start using their credit hours to remediate language arts and mathematics deficits. And as often happens with people in their early 20s, life starts to happen. And only about a third of full-time students enrolled in associate degree programs finish that program within 3 years, and those are two-year programs, so that's a 50% variation. Unfortunately, in a lot of community colleges, all the growth in curriculum has been in what are called general studies, which are more plug compatible with a four-year degree, more social studies, humanities, topics of great value, but not necessarily where you'd want those few credit hours that people are able to put in every year to take if their objective is to get steady, decent paying work.
And it overlaps with the gender point because you do, to the extent that they're at the margins, you see differences between 4 and 2 year. And more men sort of going maybe for the two-year option, is that because those completion rates are what they are, then a big contributor to the difference in college completion rates between men and women is that institutional difference, is that those men are going to those 2 years and then not graduating.
There's another issue that which is you raise in the book, which is quite interesting, about the nature of so-called heel work. Jobs in health, education, administration, and literacy, and how those careers have skewed more and more to women. But you take a very provocative position that we need to be trying to open the aperture to get more men in those careers. Talk about this whole heel phenomena and how you think that might be part of the solution.
Yeah, so the term heel is one that my colleague and I, Isabel Sawhill, came up with a few years ago for a piece we did together. And it is a sort of an attempt to look at these occupational categories that are more based around people, more around care, those sorts of professions. And we're going to see more and more people in those professions over the coming years, for sure. And what's really striking is that whereas in other occupations, we've seen a really sharp decline in the degree to which they're segregated by gender. So at the kind of highest level, law, medicine, etc. But in other levels too, we've just seen like increasing numbers of women into certain jobs. And the obvious antonym here is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Here are all these professions. So I've already talked about teachers, but nursing, social care workers, social workers, psychologists, counselors, substance abuse counselors, school counselors, etc. Big professions. And there's three reasons why I think we need to get more men in them. But number one is that actually there are jobs coming in those professions. So it would be great to get more men into them because a lot of men need jobs, especially the middle skill jobs. Now, secondly, there are labor shortages in some of those professions. So if we could just like widen, to use your analogy, the aperture of like where's the supply? So we weren't trying to solve labor market shortages with half the labor force. That might help. But thirdly, and I think perhaps most importantly, I would say now, it's just for the users of those services, whether it's boys in classrooms with male teachers, whether it's, you know, elderly gentlemen in care homes who might want a male nurse or a male care worker to help them get to the bathroom, or a substance abuse, someone suffering substance abuse who might want a male substance abuse counselor, or someone who wants psychologists. So what's interesting about these professions is that almost everyone I've listed so far is becoming progressively more gender segregated. So social work, teaching, the lines all go down for male share. Psychology is maybe the most dramatic example, where it was gender parity in the 1980s. In the last 10 years, the share of psychologists who are male has dropped from 39% to 29%. And among psychologists under the age of 30, only 5% are male. The thing that strikes me most about it is that no one is really paying attention to those trends or seeing them as a problem, either for those professions or for the labor market prospects of men or for the users of those services. And so in just the same way we've thrown money and political capital and campaigning to get more women into STEM, I think we need a similar campaign to get men into HEAL with subsidies, with scholarships, with really targeted marketing campaigns. It doesn't happen by itself. It really does take effort. It did take effort to really break down, and we've still got further to go to get women into some of those male professions. So we shouldn't just assume that magically overnight we're going to be able to degender some of these HEAL professions. It will take work and money and effort, but right now we're doing nothing. And I don't think nothing is a good response to those trends.
Well, certainly a lot of those problems start with the growing dominance of women in all post-secondary levels of education. 58% of current college enrollees, an absolute majority of all PhD students in the United States. So if you don't start upstream and get more young men successfully through high school, you will not ever get those end outcomes you were talking to. One thing our research shows, I think quite definitively, is the way employers now structure the front end of their hiring processes using something called an applicant tracking system, which is AI-based, really looks to your previous work experience and history and begins to typecast you as what you have been. In the labor market, by the time you get to be 25, 26, you will have opportunities that are very close to what you have done. And if that's nothing, or that's low wage, low skilled work that you opted for because you stopped getting an education, it becomes kind of the mark of Cain or something, and you're stuck with it.
So interesting. I mean, it's a bit like, but it's sort of the equivalent of driving, mostly using the rearview mirror. I'm sort of thinking about this through the gendered lens, just because of my current work. But this would be true of class and other factors too. But it takes some people quite a lot longer to kind of figure out like where they're going. I'm actually doing some work right now under the kind of working title "Straight Line Women, Zigzag Men." Where I'm basically just kind of looking at, if you look at this, what you see is that just like, I've already mentioned the high school graduating on time thing, huge gender gaps there. Enrolling straight into college from high school, big gender gaps there. You know, staying in college completion, gaps there. Leaving a parent's home, big gap there. Buying your own, gap, you know, into the labor market, gap. And actually college stopping out is much, much higher for men than for women. And so if you take a good example of this, let's put some data in, is college completion, right? So there's about a 10 percentage point gap in college enrollment. And here I'm just talking about four-year colleges. So I think the same would be roughly true for 2 years, but four-year colleges. But then conditional on enrolling, what are the completion rates? Well, women are 10 percentage points more likely to have graduated 4 years later. they're 6 percentage points more likely to have graduated 6 years later and 4 percentage points more likely than 10 years later. So there is a bit of a catch up. The gap gets smaller. There's a massive gap of 4 years, right? So the impression you get here is like in Europe, like you see a road is just dead straight, and the Romans would build them dead straight because they could march their troops more right, and they could march much more quickly from place A to B. And so the image I've got in my head is of young women in particular just being more like that. They're like on a Roman road. Whereas the guys, a bit more zigzaggy, a little bit more like on the country road somewhere, like driving, all right, I'm going to go that way, I'm going to go that way. They just take longer to land. So if it turns out that by the time you've landed, your fate has basically been cast, then that's potentially a bigger problem for men because it just takes them longer to get there anyway. And their prefrontal cortex is still trying to catch up till the mid-20s, right? And so, again, it's one of my arguments to give them an extra year before starting school and stuff is just because there's this developmental gap that was invisible under conditions of sexism, right? It didn't matter that women were developmentally more advanced when we didn't let them do anything. They didn't go to college anyway, so it didn't matter, right? But now that we've taken away those external unfair constraints, what we're seeing is this developmental gap showing up in a way that was basically being invisible before.
It does bring us back to this something you mentioned earlier, which is having approaches or seeking to develop new approaches that are universally applicable. It just doesn't rise to the realities that we have a population that segments by everything from capability to interest to their capacity to drive on down the Roman road versus requiring going up the zigzag of a mountainside, and that we need to accept the fact that the definition of programs does not have to include, it can accommodate everyone equally and is designed for everybody equally, just so long as it has an affirmative prospect for the population it's seeking to serve. Are there any countries you think, Richard, have elements of things we should be doing more of, or countries you're drawn to as understanding this problem in the way you're trying to cause our listeners to understand it?
Yeah, there's some signs of movement in a few countries. I mean, my analogy sometimes is the human capital first, determining everything in the labor market after, is a bit like high jump, right? Sometimes I think the opportunity structure in the US is kind of more like high jump than hurdles, right? So it's like if you make it over, you know, what did you clear? If you hit the labor market with a 4-year degree or that, boom, right? You're going to do pretty darn well, especially now. And if you don't, tough, right? So it's very determined by what happens early because of these way these institutions work. And it should be more like hurdles. It should be more like, oh, you kicked that one over, but yeah, you got over that one, and then you made it up at the end. And like I know this some of an area you're interested in as well, but this the role of internal labor markets in companies, what happens to people in their 20s and 30s, like this whole idea of like game over by 25, effectively, I think you're right that it actually underpins a lot of anxiety among policymakers for trying more innovative things because it's we don't have time for that, right? You know, like we've got to get them in the best possible shape before they make the one run at the high jump, right? It's interesting that the smallest gender gap in tertiary education across the OECD countries, it was in countries where there was more emphasis on vocational forms of tertiary education. And that feels totally intuitive to me, that like if you've got this system that does accommodate more pluralism in your pathways, then it's probably going to end up serving, you know, boys and men better. Whereas if you have this unitary structure, which is traditional education, everything else equal, you're going to get a bigger gender gap. And that does seem to map into. So I really like some of the work that those countries have historically done, not that it's immediately transferable. At a kind of more general level, you see, you know, in Australian schools, there's these boys reading clubs, but just an attempt to have these sort of, to get past some of the stigma around reading, which is huge. There's the men's sheds movement, which is about trying to create more men's community in Australia. But most top of my mind right now is just in terms of the debate about this issue. I've been really struck by just the transformation in the last few years in the UK. The UK has an all-party parliamentary group on boys and men. There's a real active discussion of a male health strategy, some kind of ministerial role. And there was debate on International Men's Day in Parliament. And I happened to be, I was deliberately there for that debate. And I remember when that was started in 2015, and the Labour Party in particular, people on the left, were just like eye-rolling about that. It was seen as completely ridiculous to have a debate on International Men's Day. This time around, substantive debate, good contributions from all sides. And the Labour Women and Equality Minister made a brilliant speech talking about education gaps, talking about her husband, etc. She was then interrupted and another Labour MP said, what about violence against women? And she said, that's a huge problem and we're debating that next week and I encourage you to attend. But, and here I'm going to quote her verbatim, this is Yasmin Qureshi. She said, but gender equality is not a zero-sum game. We can both attend to problems of violence against women and some of the problems of our boys and men and not have to choose between the two. Like, this is from the Labour benches of Parliament. And Scotland set specific targets to reduce the gender gap in their colleges, like to narrow the gender gap as an act of public policy. So things are starting to move, I would say.
One thing I write about quite a bit is, as you may know, is the role of employers, of the private sector, in trying to remediate these problems. Have you given any thought to the role companies can play? If this is a podcast from the Harvard Business School, so we'll have, I hope, a number of executives listening, so perhaps we can encourage one or more of them to be a bit innovative.
Yeah. I'm really struck by the evaluations of career academies, which are kind of small high schools, which partner with employers and kind of provide internships and stuff. Very good outcomes for the boys that went to them. And about the only policy intervention, increased earnings, etc., didn't really do much for college completion, but that wasn't the point. The point was actually to provide alternatives to college completion. These partnerships can be really powerful. And given the failures of the current educational system, particularly powerful for boys and men. And so I think that's number one. I think number two, again, I think we're overlapping a bit in some of our interests here, but like the internal labor market, like just how are you attending to your internal labor market? Are you putting kind of ceilings in place, given the big gender gap in college going, that could have gendered effects too, in terms of upward mobility, particularly during the 20 years in the middle. And the last thing is the role of employers in helping mothers and fathers to be able to balance work and home. This is obviously an issue as old as, well, it's been around many decades. But I think increasingly it's impinging on fathers. And so I think that creating what I refer to in the book as father-friendly employment is a big mission for companies now. And I think there's a few things there. Obviously, offering paid leave, etc. But secondly, creating a culture where people actually use it, as opposed to being available. And that takes leadership and example. But also just the way you structure those critical years. And here I'm thinking more about white collar jobs, but kind of late 20s into the 30s, what Claudia Goldin, your colleague at Harvard, calls these greedy jobs that just require you to just give so much to the job just as you're raising young kids. So there's this just horrible, horrible kind of situation we've created where careers are most demanding when home life is also most demanding. And then we wonder why so many parents who are right now disproportionately women are kind of struggling with that. But creating pathways, like something, there's also the mommy track. You put someone on the mommy track and she gets like left behind. Or there's the career track, right? I'm on a plane. I'm working 60 hours a week. I'm billing the clients or I'm on the mommy track. And I think what we actually need is what I would call something like the normal people track. Because most couples are dual earners now. Increasingly, fathers don't want to just be absent and sending the paycheck home. Increasingly, mothers want to be able to be mothers, but also work. And so creating different pathways, which I know some companies are trying to do, but until I really think this is a looming crisis for them, for fathers in particular. And so I deliberately call it father-friendly employment, because I think if you achieve that, you will create parent-friendly and therefore women mother-friendly employment. But you've off the bat said, we're not just talking about mothers, which I think would hugely help with gender equity as well.
In part two, we'll talk about the changing role of working fathers and the impact of COVID on work-life balance. We'll also delve into distance learning, which may not be a good fit for boys, and remote work, which offers some potential benefits.
We hope you enjoy the Managing the Future of Work podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find out more about the Managing the Future of Work project at our website, hbs.edu/Managing the Future of Work. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter.